This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with law professor Eleanor Stein, an expert on global warming.
The courts are finally taking this seriously. We'll hear about a case recently argued at the Supreme Court on regulating CO2 emissions. We'll hear about power plants, and we'll hear about what's happening to the Inuits in Canada.
We'll talk with filmmaker Abby Ginsberg from California about Soul of Justice, Felton Henderson's American journey.
Can you be a federal judge and still be a progressive? That is Felton Henderson's story.
As we've covered on Law and Disorder, students have been one of the most well-organized and vital groups. We'll talk with Andrew Doss, Director of Law Students for Governmental Accountability, working to draw attention to the systemic failures of the federal government that led to Hurricane Katrina.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Since 9/11, the Center for Constitutional Rights and now many other lawyers have been litigating the rights of people at Guantanamo Bay and at other offshore penal colonies around the world. The main issue that we have been concerned with is the right of a detainee to go into a court and demand from the government, what is your legal basis for holding me? In other words, why am I here? We lawyers call this filing a writ of habeas corpus. It's the fundamental protection, in my view, against a police state. It's the fundamental protection that prohibits the king, the president, whoever, from grabbing you by the nape of the neck, tossing you in a clinker, and having you never heard from again. And that's what's at issue at Guantanamo and in penal colonies around the world that the United States is running. Twice, the center and other lawyers have gone to the Supreme Court, and twice the Supreme Court has said detainees at Guantanamo have the right to file writs of habeas corpus, have the right to demand from the federal government the reasons for their incarceration. Twice the Bush administration has gone to Congress and said, we don't want them to have that right. We're taking it away. We want you to take it away. And twice Republican Congresses have complied. Well, this last time, we've gotten it into court again. And we've all been awaiting a decision that came down last week in a series of the Guantanamo cases that the center has been coordinating. And sadly, we lost that decision in a 2-1 vote. People ask me, well, you lost the decision. What does it mean? How can it be that Congress can overrule the Supreme Court? Well, it's a technicality, but it's not just a technicality. The Supreme Court, in its two decisions, said that people have a statutory right to habeas corpus or go to court. In other words, a statute that Congress passed gave them that right. The Supreme Court did not rule on whether there was a constitutional right to go into court on habeas. And so when Congress eliminated habeas corpus, they simply rewrote the statute, Congress believing, at least the Republican majority, that there was no constitutional right to habeas. So what happens in the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, where a bunch of the Guantanamo cases are pending? Two of the judges said Congress was right, the president was right, the Constitution does not protect the rights of non-citizens held at Guantanamo to file a writ of habeas corpus or to have their basis of their detention set forth by the government in a federal court. One judge dissented, saying this is ridiculous. The Constitution, not only today, but in 1789, was clear that non-citizens under the jurisdiction of the United States who are held inside or outside the country had the right to habeas. The case is going to the Supreme Court for sure, but let's say this. It's now been 5.5 years. It'll be another year by the time we get a Supreme Court decision. 6.5 years, 395 men being held at Guantanamo. None of them have been charged. None of them have had a trial. None of them have actually had a hearing in federal court, despite our winning of 2 victories in the Supreme Court. It's a slow, hard road to go. But imagine how those guys in Guantanamo feel, and imagine even more the authority that has now been given to the President of the United States by the court and by Congress. He can go anywhere in the world. Some of these people were from the Gambia, some from Thailand, some from Afghanistan. The president can go anywhere in the world, pick up any non-citizen anywhere in the world, put them in an offshore detention facility, disappear them, deny them access to a lawyer, and hold them forever without charging them. That's the so-called democracy that the Bush administration is bringing to us today. Okay, I don't know if all our listeners have heard of the Doomsday Clock, but when I was a kid, the Doomsday Clock was one of the scariest timepieces you could look at because it would move and advance the minute hand based on the nuclear threat. And the closer it got to midnight, the closer it meant to us all being wiped out in some kind of nuclear holocaust. Well, recently, the minute hand on the Doomsday Clock was set to 5 minutes to midnight. That's the closest it's been to midnight since the clock began. The clock was set up initially by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Well, 5 minutes to midnight, and it's not about a nuclear holocaust. This time, it was advanced to 5 minutes to midnight because of global warming. Yes, you heard me right, global warming. Scarier than a nuclear holocaust to the people who set the clock. Meanwhile, although it's 5 minutes to midnight, and the minute hand is advancing minute by minute, as they say, the Bush administration is continuing to play down the threat of climate change and global warming. Last May, on Law and Disorder, we aired speeches from the Catastrophic Climate Change Forum at Albany Law School. We included speakers such as Dr. James Hansen, the director of NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Hansen cited hard evidence that we are facing catastrophic climate change from global warming, and we are reaching a tipping point where we can no longer save ourselves or our planet. Today, we'll be speaking with Eleanor Stein, who's an adjunct professor of law at Albany Law School, who's an expert on global warming and will bring us up to date on 3 major litigations that are being, hopefully, placed in the way of the continued global warming of our cities, our countries, and our planet. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Eleanor Stein.
Thank you very much.
Eleanor, our listeners should know that you're a professor of law up in Albany and that you've been active in several environmental lawsuits. We wanted to talk to you about those today. Of the lawsuits that you're going on now with your help, what ones would you choose to single out and tell our listeners about?
Well, there's an enormous amount happening in this area, and not only lawsuits, but also there's a number of bills now been introduced in Congress. There's a lot of activity on the state and local level and on a regulatory front. But in terms of litigation, I wanted to focus on 3 pieces of litigation, which I think are really the critical ones for people to know about right now. One is a case that is currently pending at the Supreme Court challenging the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for failing to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant.
What's the name of that case?
Yeah, that's Massachusetts against EPA.
That was argued already, right, Eleanor?
It was argued on November 29th.
Right, I remember reading something about
it. The second case is a case that was brought against 5 Midwestern power plant owners by a coalition of 7 states' attorneys general, including Elliot Spitzer, and the city of New York. That is a claim that the global warming-related emissions of those power plants constitute a public nuisance. And that case, which is the state of Connecticut against American Electric Power, was dismissed by a district court in New York and is now appeal is pending at the Second Circuit. And the third is an international case, and this is a petition brought by members of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference against the United States in the Organization of American States Inter-American Human Rights Commission, charging the United States with human rights violations for the global warming-related effects on people of the Arctic, indigenous people of the Arctic.
And the EPA case that's been argued, how does the government justify its actions in that case?
That's the carbon dioxide case, right?
Ultimately, they're all carbon dioxide cases, right? This claim was basically the states had asked the EPA to categorize carbon dioxide as an air pollutant. And traditionally, since the Clean Air Act of 1990, the EPA has regulated sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, and other smog-related and acid rain-related and, you know, the classic air pollutant. But it has never regulated carbon dioxide as an air pollutant.
And why hasn't it?
Well, I think as a practical matter, it's only been in the last 10 or 15 years that our understanding of the effects of carbon dioxide has become as sophisticated as it is now, although 25, 30 years ago, there were scientists who were exploring the global warming effects of carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide comes from cars, right?
Automobiles and airplanes, that's about a third. Power plants is about another third. Buildings, factories, and housing stock is another third. So to really aggressively reduce the emissions, you have to hit it on all three of those areas.
So they've refused to regulate that at all. Is that the point?
This case was brought in the context of regulations affecting new automobile emissions. And the EPA said, first of all, that they were not authorized to regulate CO2 as a pollutant under the language of the Clean Air Act, which is kind of silly on its face because the language is very general and generous to the agency. Second, they said, even if we were authorized, we choose not to do so as a matter of policy. And they did that without any scientific findings or investigation and really without much of a record. And those are the bases for the challenge.
And what did our side say?
Our side said, you are certainly authorized to do so, and you certainly should do so as a matter of policy. And litigants put forward, as you can imagine, a very comprehensive set of documents, a massive record showing the devastating effects of climate change on the plaintiff states. New York, for example, would lose hundreds of miles of territory, square miles of territory. So they were acting in their sovereign capacity in bringing these lawsuits. And they said, not only can you and should you, but you are precluded from simply refusing on its face to regulate CO2 without an in-depth current scientific record, which the EPA did not compile. When the case was argued at the Supreme Court, it really, although it's the first global warming case to get to the Supreme Court, the petitioners argued in the first instance, this is an administrative law case. You don't have to decide the science of global warming to see that this agency can and should act. It was a very interesting argument, and the court was split, of course. Justice Scalia said, I don't want to think about global warming. I don't want to make decisions about science, and isn't the whole thing kind of overblown? But a lot of the other judges were troubled, and they were troubled by the thin arguments of the EPA, and I think they're probably somewhat more troubled now after the release of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Yeah, why don't you mention at least some of the conclusions of that? That just came out a few days ago, as I recall.
Yeah, it came out in January, and you know, this is the sort of obscure language of the international scientific community. This report is vetted by scientists in over 150 countries. So what you get is sort of the lowest common denominator. But even on that basis, the report is basically says there's at least a 90% chance that the climate change that we're measuring and experiencing is the result of human activity. So to the extent there was an argument about that in the last 10 years, that argument has been put to rest. In terms of looking at the effects, they do predict a 2 to 4 degree centigrade increase over the rest of this century. They don't, interestingly, analyze the effect of the melting Greenland glaciers on sea level rise, and so experts in this field look at this as a very conservative estimate of what the likely outcomes are going to be. And those estimates, most recently by Bill McKibben in the New York Review of Books and by Jim Hansen at NASA, are pretty frightening numbers about sea level rise and changes in the planet that are irreversible and truly make this, as Hansen says, a very different planet.
We're speaking, for listeners who've just tuned into Law and Disorder, with Professor Eleanor Stein of the Albany Law School. She's an expert on environmental law. She's talking to us about three major cases that are going on now. The second one, which she's about to talk about, is the case that various attorney generals, including ours, Spitzer, before he ascended to the governorship, have brought because of power plant pollution. And Eleanor, I wanted to ask you about that second case on the power plants and, you know, what's the matter with them?
What's the matter with the power plants?
Yeah.
Well, this case was, it's the state of Connecticut against American Electric Power Company. And it's an interesting tactical choice to go after the private industry electric generators rather than against the federal government. So you can see that these are two different but complementary litigation strategies. And here the strategy was to single out five of the electric generation corporations that collectively were responsible for about 25% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, which makes them responsible for about 1% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. And they're primarily located in the Midwest, and their power plants are primarily in the Midwest, and they tend to be on the dirtier end, coal plants and oil plants and some gas plants, older technologies that emit far more carbon dioxide than the more modern plants or than, let's say, windmills or hydropower. The cause of action here was public nuisance, and the claim is that collectively the greenhouse gas emissions of these five corporations constitutes the public nuisance or contributes to the public nuisance of global warming, and the litigants cataloged all of the effects on the petitioner states of the growth in CO2 emissions over the last 20 years and essentially claimed that a certain important percentage of those emissions were attributable to those five corporations.
Eleanor, doesn't the claim of public nuisance give the parties affected by the pollution the right to act against sources across state lines?
That was the claim, yes. And there's support for that, some classic public nuisance environmental cases. There were motions to dismiss by the five power companies, as you can imagine, on a range of grounds, the most aggressive being their claims that all of these issues have been long since codified in the Clean Air Act, and that the whole claim of public nuisance doesn't survive the Clean Air Act, and that the states are relegated to remedy under the Clean Air Act. And as we know, the EPA is saying under the Clean Air Act they're not going to regulate CO2. So that's saying you have a remedy, which is to go hit your head against a brick wall. Basically, the expectation in the community scholars and litigation experts who were following this case was that it was likely to be dismissed by the district court on preemption ground or Clean Air Act grounds. And actually, the judge dismissed the case on a ground that had not been really briefed by either side, which was our old friend and your old friend, the political question doctrine.
Yeah.
And she held, this was Judge Preska, held that the question essentially of energy policy and foreign policy were relegated to the executive, and the executive had made a set of decisions about our energy policy, which we're not going to be second-guessed by the courts.
Yeah, so the power plants are just, you know, spewing it out. But let me shift gears, Eleanor Stein, and ask you about the Inuit case, which is just fascinating in terms of human rights. Can you explain to our listeners what's at stake here?
Well, a great deal is at stake. This was a very creative petition filed at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is a body of the Organization of American States, to which, of course, the United States is a signatory. And this petition claimed that the greenhouse gas emissions for which the United States was responsible constituted a human rights violation against the Inuit people. And it was brought by Inuit individuals from Canada, Russia, and other countries in the Arctic Circle. And the claim was that the really devastating global warming impacts on the Arctic in particular resulted from the U.S. emissions. And they compiled, again, a very compelling and humanly compelling record of the devastation brought to their lands and their culture by the increase in global temperature and sea temperature. And those increases are magnified in the Arctic. They call themselves the canary in the mine. And the processes that are resulting in warming and melting all over the Earth are exacerbated in the Arctic and have proceeding at about twice the rate. So these are people who largely have had a subsistence traditional economy and culture based on hunting and fishing, which is at best endangered and possibly truly dying out because of the disappearance of summer ice, because of the melting of the permafrost, the danger to polar bears and other Arctic species on whom they depend for food. So this petition unified the different Inuit communities in different countries and brought them to the Inter-American Commission with this claim against the United States.
And how do you expect they'll rule? When do you think they'll rule? And will their ruling actually be carried out if it goes in our favor?
Good questions. They initially actually denied the petition in mid-December of 2006. And interestingly, it was just announced that, and the Inuit requested argument, which is something that's provided for by the commission, shortly after the release of the fourth assessment report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the commission granted the request for argument, and the Inuit will be arguing on March 1st.
Eleanor, I'm amazed. That's amazing. No idea.
Yeah.
When did you find that out?
Just a couple of days ago.
Before or after I saw you?
Actually, right after I saw you, and I even sent you an email about it.
I missed the email.
The emails like that.
Well, that's very exciting.
Yeah, it's a tremendous, tremendous victory to be able
it's
to
huge.
Argue their case. And I think that the fourth assessment report, even with its weaknesses, was a real wake-up call. And it also meant for judicial-type bodies that may be reluctant to take on issues of science, the consensus of the world scientists expressed in such strong terms, I think, may have given them some comfort level that the science decisions have been made. Now the question is, what are we going to do about it?
But is the argument going to be on the merits or really on whether this is an appropriate case for the commission?
I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't see that in the reports
right.
that I read. But they'll be there.
We were able to tape a speech by James Hansen. And we'd like you to tell our listeners who he is so that we can play a clip for them.
James Hansen is the director of something called the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, which is a part of NASA. And he is also a professor at Columbia University. And he's one of the foremost climate scientists in this country and probably in the world. And he's one of the first, probably he is the first, to bring the attention of the scientific world to the issue of global warming as far back as the 1980s. And he testified before Congress. There's a clip of him doing so in Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. They both look very young in that clip. Gore was a senator, and Hansen was testifying before the Senate on global warming in the late 80s. And he's been a consistent voice for scientists taking responsibility for the outcome of their researches and to try to get government to act. He is the one who was, his reports were stifled and edited by the Bush administration for quite some time until he spoke up last year.
We'll now hear a clip from James Hansen at the 2006 Catastrophic Climate Change Forum.
If we stay on business as usual for the rest of this century, even the next half century, we will get warming of more than 2 degrees Celsius, so that the planet would be aiming toward a sea level rise of the order of 25 meters. The question is, how long would it take to get that? And it had been assumed in the last IPCC report, for example, that it takes millennia for the ice sheets to respond. But that's based on the past changes of the ice sheets, which tended to go along with the slow forcings that occur on the natural paleoclimate timescales. The ice sheets, the forcings change very slowly, and they're very extremely weak. It's mostly feedbacks that are occurring. The area in which we're getting summer melt on the ice sheets is increasing. This compares 1992 and 2002. And 2005, could I have the next one, had even a larger area of melting. The regions with dark red dots had melt last year for the first time. As the Greenland is getting warmer, the area of melt is increasing. Just in the last 3 years, we have this spectacular satellite called GRACE, which is a gravity satellite, which measures the gravity field of the Earth with such precision that you can measure the mass of the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet. And what is found is that the mass of Greenland is decreasing. In the last year, it decreased by 200 cubic kilometers, which is 50 cubic miles. So it's as if you have a cube 1 mile on a side and 1 mile high. 50 of those melted in this last year. Well, if you spread that around the world ocean, it's only half a millimeter of sea level rise, or five centimeters in a century. But the rate at which that is occurring is rapidly increasing. This is a graph of glacial earthquakes. You have seismometers located around the world, and when an earthquake occurs, you can the seismometers register that there's an earthquake, and you can, because you have many different seismometers, you can tell exactly where it came from. And what they've discovered is in the last several years is that there are earthquakes on Greenland. And what those earthquakes are is the when that water lubricates the base of the ice sheet enough, it'll suddenly move forward and then stop again. You know, it runs in the ground and stops. But that registered as an earthquake with a magnitude between 4.6 and 5.1. And those ice quakes are occurring right at the places where the ice is being discharged as icebergs into the ocean. The amount of these ice quakes doubled between the early 1990s and the late 1990s, and then it's doubled again. Last year was four times what it was a decade or so earlier. And the flux of water going to the ocean is increasing as this happens. Could I have the next one, please? So let's think about what would a 25-meter sea level rise imply. This is New York City area. Manhattan is down here. GWB is the George Washington Bridge. So you can see there's still a little bit of land that would be above water by the George Washington Bridge. But Long Island has become Short Island. And next one is Washington, I think, where the White House would be under several meters of water. And and the next one, okay, this shows the, again, this is for the 25 meter change in sea level. You can see that Florida is mostly underwater. A lot of cities along the East Coast would be underwater, as well as Louisiana and Texas. China, Shanghai, and their large populated regions that would be underwater. And India and Bangladesh would be underwater. So this is the population chart. And it turns out that half the people in the world live within 50 miles of the coastline. You can see that the population density in Bangladesh and India and China is very high near the coastlines. And if we just take the product of the sea level rise, so what would be the population underwater with 25 meters of sea level rise? The east coast of the United States is 41 million people. In Bangladesh, the population is 137 million, but 109 million would be underwater, so most of the country would be underwater. Even a place like Japan, which is a mountainous island, has 39 million people underwater. So you're talking a huge change. And this, the thing about sea level rise, if we really go for this business as usual so that we head the planet in that direction, what would happen is this century we would probably get at the beginning, the change is slow. But because of these multiple positive feedbacks, it's a very nonlinear process. And when it starts to go faster, we know that sea level goes up rapidly.
That was James Hansen at the 2006 Catastrophic Climate Change Forum.
I just wanted to tell you a story that I heard from Hansen, which is that he always began his talks by saying the mission of NASA, NASA's mission statement begins with the sentence, our first mission is to understand and protect the home planet. And he'd always use that as the context for his global warming research and presentations. And about 8 months ago, after he was, you know, embattled on the question of whether he could speak out or not, he went to his website, the NASA website, when he got to work one morning and saw that the mission statement of NASA had been changed and that sentence had been removed.
That's great. Yeah. So it no longer opens with this.
Fascinating.
now we're out there to protect outer space, I guess.
Yeah. Well, exactly. On to Mars.
Right.
Eleanor Stein, we want to thank you very much for being such a well-spoken guest on Law and Disorder. It's always a treat to talk to you. Good luck on the litigation you're involved in. You know, lots resting on it.
I hope we don't have a long, hot summer. All right.
Thanks, Eleanor. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Soul of Justice, Felton Henderson's American Journey, chronicles one man's influence on the American judicial system. The first black attorney in the Civil Rights Division of the Kennedy Justice Department, Felton Anderson was later appointed by President Jimmy Carter as one of the first African-American federal judges in the United States. His decisions have been informed by a profound sense of fairness, distinguished also by his tenacity in seeing that they are enforced, even in the face of great political opposition. Soul of Justice includes rare archival footage and interviews with lawyers and a Supreme Court justice. We are delighted to have award-winning filmmaker Abby Ginsberg talk to us about Felton Henderson and the making of a remarkable film about a remarkable man. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Abby.
Thank you for having me.
Early in the film, we learn about Felton Henderson's decision to loan a car to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., a decision that cost him his job at the Justice Department. How did that affect the rest of his career?
Well, I think in two ways. One of the things you might say is that since he was, you know, this was, as he says in the film, this is my first job, and, you know, I wasn't sure where I was going from here. One of the things that it shows is that he obviously went on and continued to have a career as a civil rights lawyer and then ultimately as a federal court judge, and he's done great things throughout his career. But, you know, being fired from your first job as the first black attorney in the Justice Department might have stopped a lesser man in his tracks. But Judge Henderson really picked himself up, dusted himself off, came back to California, and, you know, went to work. So the good news is it sort of revealed a strength of character. You know, and I think in retrospect, that act, you know, may very well have saved Dr. King's life at the time. So I think in retrospect, it is also an act of which he's actually quite proud, in spite of the fact that it cost him his job. But at the time, I think he didn't realize how it was all going to play out.
He talks about a lifelong internal tension. I think it's between whether to exercise a kind of judicial restraint in all of his actions and then the other side being expressing his own political viewpoints. Did that inform the way he presided over his many cases?
Well, I think what he says in the film, and I think it really goes to the essence of who he is as a person, is that when he went south, he felt torn between, as he says, his role as a black man who hated everything that he saw going on, you know, and his job as a government attorney, which forced him to be somewhat more distant than, say, the civil rights movement had to be in the face of the injustice. And so, as he says, was I going to throw myself into the wheels of injustice and make a big statement, or was I going to do my job? And I think for him, you know, there has always been a little bit of both restraint, and he's never thrown himself into the wheels of injustice in quite that way, but he has ruled and been against and served his entire life, essentially, against injustice. And so what I think the conclusion one draws from looking at the film is that, you know, he happened to end up in the best job he could possibly have found, both for himself temperamentally and for himself intellectually, and the world's a better place because he became a federal judge. Not everybody has the judicial temperament that he has, but he showed that temperament early on in the South, and I think that's what that quote you were referring to reflects.
We're speaking to listeners who just tuned in with Abby Ginsberg, who's a producer-director out in the Bay Area, and she's done a movie, just came out, called Soul of Justice, Thelton Henderson's American Journey. Henderson is a federal court judge out in the Bay Area, probably the most progressive judge out on the West Coast. And I wanted to ask you, Abby, what was it that led you to make this movie, and what was it that allowed Judge Henderson to let you do it?
I think the fact that he didn't know what he was getting into is why he agreed to do it. That's what he says about it. He said, oh, I thought it'd be one interview for an hour. He didn't know it was going to be nine interviews over, you know, often 3 hours, and that he'd have to go fishing with me as well. What made me want to do it is that he has been a long-term, you know, kind of hero of mine. And I felt like in sharing his story with a general public and maybe with some, you know, everybody from high school students through practicing lawyers and others who'd never heard of him, that I would be able to say something about what justice on the bench really looks like, what it means to be committed to social justice, and what a lifelong commitment to trying to make the world a better place, you know, looks like through his personal story. The other thing that drew me to the story is that inside of his story, because he's an African-American and 73 years old, you're looking at kind of a little bit of the history of race relations in America. He was one of the first in almost every place that he went. When he went to Bolt Hall, he was one of two blacks in his class, and as he says, the year after him, there was one. When he became an attorney for the, you know, Department of Justice, he was the first black in the Civil Rights Division. He was the first black person hired at Stanford Law School, et cetera, et cetera. And then was alone on the bench as the only black lawyer, the only black judge, sorry, on the San Francisco federal bench for 10 years, from 1980 to 1990. And so if you look at his life story, you realize how long it's taken us, you know, to begin to see some diversity in each of these various aspects of American life. And so I felt like I get to say something about how far we still have to go and maybe something about how far we've come.
You did that very beautifully, Abby. I was actually fascinated to learn that the judge presided over the multi-year Dolphin Protection Standards case. Had he ever bowed to political pressure?
No. I mean, not as far as I know. I think that he has taken very seriously the fact that he has a lifetime appointment, you know, essentially with tenure unless he does something, you know, really illegal, and has really used his discretion extremely well. And so it's like, what can they do to him if the U.S. government or the Department of Commerce doesn't like his rulings? So he's not a guy with his finger in the air looking at which way the political winds are blowing. He never has been. And as he says in the film at some point, in the Dolphin case, you know, the thing that gets him the most is when somebody flagrantly, essentially disobeys one of his orders. So when the tuna boats go out to sea, once he told them they couldn't and they go anyway, he finds creative ways to drag those guys back in. And that was true years ago when there was an immigrant who he was considering their case, and at some point the INS sends the guy on a bus back to Mexico. He stopped that bus and made a turnaround. That is something that the average federal judge doesn't really think about doing. You know, it's more, oh, well, we tried, we couldn't get him to turn around, that's it, he's going to Mexico, too bad, sorry. The boats are out to sea, too bad. And what is unique, I think, about Judge Henderson is that he is going to use every ounce of federal authority that he has to see that his rulings are enforced. And that takes us to the fact that he now put the California health care prison system, or prison health care system, under federal receivership because after, you know, trying for 10 years to get the California prison system to reform itself, he finally had to kind of give up and say, this isn't working, so we're going to put you under federal receivership and see if, under the control of the federal government, maybe some things can happen and we can stop killing people in the California prison system through bad medical care.
There was a great scene during his first visit to Pelican Bay Prison in which he suspects that the prison guards staged the inmate uprising. So it comes across when his law clerks explain that he was not only a true intellectual, but also very streetwise and savvy.
You know, people have commented about how they feel like he evolves in the course of the movie, from someone who's a little bit more naive to someone who definitely has his ear to the ground and becomes much more street savvy. And I think that's right, that you can't put one over on him anymore. You know, so even if there were some surprises for him early on in his career, by now he's seen it all, experienced it all, and he's always a step ahead of, you know, essentially the people trying to put one over on him.
Abby, I wanted to ask you about what happened when he dealt with Proposition 209. First of all, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Abby Ginsberg, who's a producer-director out in the Bay Area. She's made a wonderful film called Soul of Justice about Judge Thelton Henderson's American journey. He's an African-American judge out in San Francisco who made a number of wonderful, courageous decisions. One of them had to do with Proposition 209. Abby, tell us, what was Proposition 209? What did the judge do about it?
Okay, well, Proposition 209 was, you know, the beginning of the anti-affirmative action campaigns that have been going on around the country, led by a man named Ward Connerly, who was a UC regent. And it was a proposition on the ballot. It was called the Civil Rights Initiative, that essentially outlawed affirmative action in both state hiring and state higher education, so that you could no longer consider race or gender as a means of making a decision as to whether someone could be admitted to the UC system or to Bolt Law School or to UC Medical School, et cetera. And it could no longer be considered for any kind of any state employment as well. This thing passed by about 54% in California, and it was immediately challenged by the ACLU, the Equal Justice Society, and other groups claiming that it was unconstitutional because it unfairly burdened the ability of minorities and women to gain access to these, let's just deal with education, the educational institutions, but it didn't do anything about student-athletes, it didn't do anything about legacies, people whose fathers and mothers had gone to these institutions. There was essentially still affirmative action for other groups, but it was now being eliminated for minorities and for women. And Judge Henderson found that it, in fact, was unconstitutional, believed that he was on very strong constitutional ground. He was citing Supreme Court cases for this. And, you know, for 5 minutes, the proposition was overturned by him. But, in fact, when it went up to the Ninth Circuit, they reversed him lickety-split with a very negative opinion, accusing him of overturning the will of the people. And as the film says, and as he believes, you know, that's his job as a federal judge, that when some unconstitutional proposition passes, it is his job to declare it unconstitutional. But he took a lot of personal heat for that decision.
We're speaking with Abby Ginsberg, who's done this wonderful movie called Soul of Justice about federal judge Thelton Henderson. And I think our listeners would really like to see the movie. And we have listeners all over the country and all over the tri-state area here in New York. But how do they do that? Where is it shown around New York?
Well,
how do they get a hold of you if they want to stage a screening?
Okay. So first of all, it will be screened at Columbia Law School at 6 o'clock at 116th Street and Amsterdam Avenue on Monday, February 26th.
That's tonight.
Oh. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And where else?
It will be screened tomorrow night, Tuesday, February 27th, at NYU Law School. These are both events that are open to the public, 6 o'clock for both events. And NYU, it is at Tishman Auditorium in Vanderbilt Hall at 40 Washington Square South.
Is there a website you can go to get information about those two showings?
Soulofjustice.org, and that is, you can also go through soulofjustice.org and click on purchase if you want to buy a copy of it, and it takes you to the newsreel, California Newsreel for the distributor, and it takes it to their website, and you can buy it automatically online.
And we'll link up with our website and yours, Abby.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Okay.
Great, Abby.
Thanks, Abby.
Thanks, Abby. As we've covered on Law and Disorder, students have been one of the most well-organized and vital groups working to draw attention to the systemic failures of the federal government that led to Hurricane Katrina. Law Students for Governmental Accountability is working to educate the public about the entrenched short-sightedness that led to these tragic events. The group developed out of the Student Hurricane Network in the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. They realize that lobbying, in addition to direct service, is essential to effecting fundamental change that could prevent another disaster. Their goal is to show the public the broader impact of what happened in New Orleans. Support for Law Students for Governmental Accountability is growing. They've met with and received encouragement from the offices of both Louisiana senators and the three New Orleans area U.S. representatives. We're delighted to welcome Andrew Doss, Director of Law Students for Governmental Accountability, to Law and Disorder. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Heidi.
Why, Andrew, are students in a particularly good position to take on this kind of effort?
There's a number of very important reasons. The first is that we're a national organization. There's many groups and organizations working on issues involving prevention of disaster, such as Katrina, but many of them have been dismissed as being from the Gulf Coast or seeking another handout. As a national group, we can come from Iowa and Portland, Maine, and Portland, Oregon, and show that this is a national issue with national responsibility and national consequences. The other important aspect is that we're bearing no allegiance but the cause and seeking no benefit but security and justice everywhere. As law students, we have the credibility of training to work in a serious profession and understanding the legislative structures of government and the Constitution, but at the same time, not having any direct benefit, especially any kind of financial benefit that could come to us to be able to be dismissed.
Now, you mentioned talking about the causes of the disaster and its consequences. Can you give us just a few examples of factors that contributed to the disaster?
Absolutely. We're putting together the first comprehensive legal analysis demonstrating the federal government's comprehensive responsibility for actually causing the flooding. Starting with the year 1927, when there was a major flood, it was the largest natural disaster in American history previously, if we could call this a natural disaster this time around.
Good point.
Starting with that 1927 year, the federal government, especially through the Army Corps of Engineers, congressional oversight, and the executive administration oversight, all of those branches made decisions which led directly to the flooding, decisions about primarily about the wetlands of along the Gulf Coast.
Meaning, did they cut back the wetlands?
It largely had to do with how the oil and gas industry was allowed to slice and dice the wetlands, which served as the first storm barrier. And that was very much a part of the government's plan, or rather, it was under the government's responsibility, especially in terms of the Army Corps of Engineers, who was responsible for the entire Mississippi River from top to bottom and shaping that and administering it, as well as the wetlands and how the river and the wetlands interacted, finally, with the levees.
So this has been building up for quite a while, this gross negligence.
Yes, absolutely.
In addition to the lobbying day, what is your specific action plan after you go to D.C.? You're researching, and will you be presenting papers?
Yes, we're lobbying. We're bringing this case that we're compiling, laying out this history of federal responsibility in the form of a legal brief. We're bringing this case to Congress and lobbying for a foundational statement of principles, which is primarily an implicit recognition of federal responsibility, because right now there is not a sense that this is anything other than a local issue. So an implicit recognition of that federal responsibility and an explicit commitment to make sure it doesn't happen again, not along the Gulf Coast and not anywhere else in the country.
Are the students in Law Students for Government Accountability drafting suggestions to help prevent this in the future as part of your statement of principles?
We're taking on the full legislation. Basically, the statement of principles is a step towards the legislation, without which the legislation will not come.
I see.
Until the federal government recognizes and until the nation recognizes that the federal government has responsibility to deal with this, the legislation that's necessary to prevent it from happening again will not be produced. So in order to get the $250 billion of legislation necessary to prevent it and it's already projected to have cost our country over $1 trillion. So $250 billion to prevent something even worse from happening is really a drop in the bucket, especially when you count in the lives and the despair and everything else. In order to get to that legislation, we're bringing the statement of principles to lay the foundation. We're working right now with the lead people in Congress writing such legislation, and of course with various organizations along the Gulf Coast working on similar issues, to make sure that the legislation which comes out both fulfills that statement of principles and addresses the needs of the people on the ground along the Gulf Coast, but of course as well the people across the country.
What has the response been? It sounds as though you have some support among legislators. Have they generally been receptive to this?
Yes. We've been working with the Louisiana delegation as the first people we went to, and they've been very helpful. They helped us come up with a lot of what the statement of principles should be and helped us get some of the tight wording down. We've gone to a few national offices who have been very cooperative and want to help a lot. Senator Kennedy being a lead one, as somebody who we've met with and has expressed a desire to support when the time is right. A few offices like that that we've gone to. However, this is where we've seen some kind of hesitation nationally has been due to the fact that our country still does not recognize that this is something that concerns all of us. They don't know that, for instance, we have the first national economic analysis put together by Tim Ryan of the University of New Orleans, the president there and an economist, which shows that it's already going to have cost our country $648 billion just in terms of consumer impact in four industries. State by state, that's $5.7 billion over the last year alone in New York, but it's projected to be almost 10 times that within the next 10 years. People don't see that if we don't take care of the heart of the country, I guess the lifeblood where 60% of our nation's truck cargo comes in through the Port of New Orleans, for instance, we're going to suffer as a whole country. And so that's where the hesitance has been, as people are starting to understand that more and more, but the issue, again, needs to be brought to their attention further.
So they're slowly starting to see the big picture and how it impacts everyone.
Exactly.
What kind of resources do you draw on?
We've got an incredible group of people helping us out. The Center for Progressive Reform is a national organization of law professors and students who are working on environmental justice issues. They're helping to arrange our case for us. They're really taking the major lead on that because they're the experts in the field. Of course, we've had wonderful assistance from the National Lawyers Guild. We were invited to speak at their conference last year, and they're helping to get the word out.
And it's certainly a wonderful project to work on while in law school. What's your website, Andrew?
It's lsga.net.
And the statement of principles is on there, and the case will be posted there when it's finished?
Sure. We do have a 30-page overview of it right now, too.
And how can our listeners help?
The main way that the listeners can help, there's many different ways. The first thing is we're still in the process of getting the word out, both to recruit students, to try to help them get support in getting financial support and transportation from across the country to Washington. So if they're able to donate online, that would be fantastic. But primarily, it's getting the word out to those students so that they know, so that they can take part. We want to make sure that everybody in the country has an opportunity to be involved in that way.
And tell us again the date of the Washington Lobbying Day.
It's March 14th, and it's right in the middle of 87 law schools' spring breaks. So we're hoping that will help facilitate the chance for students to get there and really be a part of something very exciting and hopefully will develop into a movement to be remembered for a long time.
Andrew, how many students are you hoping to get?
We're looking to get 1,000 law students, two from every congressional district in the country is our goal. We've got over 100 signed up now and here at the beginning stages of a major recruiting push and seeking to The possibilities are endless as to how many we could end up with, but we just want to keep that figure right now as our goal. But again, it's just trying, that number is not, the key is making the splash that's necessary to make sure that the national political will shifts and people see that what happens in New Orleans affects people in Iowa and Washington.
Andrew, we wish you the best of luck, not only in March, but also in your overall goals, and we hope that you get a lot of continued support.
Thank you so much, Heidi, for your support and, of course, for inviting us to be on the show.
We'll put a link to your website on ours on Law and Disorder and hope to stay in touch with you. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.